the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hi there from Hong Kong. How are you all? Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast, brought to you by Kraken, the best place to buy, sell, and trade digital currencies. I'm your host, Peter McCormack, and today I have an interview with Andrew Polstra, head of research at Blockstream. But before I do that, I have a message from my show sponsors. So let's talk about BlockFi and their new announcement. They have launched crypto interest accounts. Have you checked them out yet? I caught up with Zach, the CEO of BlockFi in New York, to ask him some things about this. So let's hear what he has to say. So Zach, you've got a new announcement.
A very exciting announcement, yeah.
What do you got to tell us?
So we're launching the BlockFi interest account, which is the first time ever that clients of BlockFi can earn compound interest on their Bitcoin, paid in Bitcoin.
Is it like a bank account?
It is designed like a savings account at a bank, where you earn interest every month, and then after you've earned that interest, you earn more interest on that interest, except we're doing it with Bitcoin.
And what are the main features of the account?
So we're starting with a 6% annual yield. Like I said, it's paid out monthly, so that equates to a 6.2% effective return on the year. Assets are custodied with Gemini, and we generate the return by lending the Bitcoin to institutional investors who are borrowing it secured by dollars. So it's a similarly low risk type of lending to what we're doing on the USD loan side of things.
That sounds amazing. How do people find out more about it?
Go to BlockFi.com. We've updated the website. You can get onboarded very easily in just minutes and read all about it on the website and our blog. And don't hesitate to contact our support team as well if you have any questions.
Okay, and let's also talk about Cash App again, and a massive thanks to them for supporting the show, both with the Mt. Gox shows and over the last few weeks. It's been a real pleasure to work with them. So have you downloaded it yet? Have you got the Cash App? Have you tried it out? You must have heard about them, right? But you can't help but not heard about the work that Jack's been doing, trying to promote Bitcoin and Lightning. So definitely go check them out. Go and download the app. I've got it. It's so cool. It's so easy to use. So easy to send and receive money. And do you know what? It is the first traditional peer-to-peer payments app to support Bitcoin. It comes with most of the features of a traditional bank, like you've got the ability to direct deposit your paycheck into the app. You get a physical, customizable debit card, which is linked for you to spend from, and you get the ability to earn 10% cash back from places like Whole Foods with your cash boosts. And this can be used in tandem with your Bitcoin balance. It's such a cool app. Nothing out there like it. So go and download it. Go and check it out. It's available on the Apple and Google Play stores. Just search for Cash App, which is C-A-S-H-A-P-P. And just a note, the Bitcoin buying and selling is only available in the US right now. Okay, so I am leaving Hong Kong in a few hours. I've had such a fun time here, such an amazing place. MCing the Token 2049 event, my first time doing this, was really cool. I've met a whole bunch of cool Bitcoin people, and I had the pleasure of doing a fireside chat with Charlie Lee, who was one of the first people to come on the podcast. So that was such a great experience. I'm flying out to LA for a few days, going to take a couple of days off. I definitely need it. But whilst I'm there, I'm going to be interviewing Mark Weinstein, one of the co-founders of the Fire Festival, so that should be pretty interesting. I also want you to check out a couple of events. Firstly, check out the Magical Crypto Conference, which is being held in New York. That's being organized by Fluffy Pony, Whale Panda, Charlie Lee, and Samson Mao. It's on the 11th and 12th of May. You can get tickets for as little as $280, and they have assembled an amazing set of speakers, including Adam Back, Peter Todd, and Jameson Lopp, to name a few. I'll be there, so check that out at magicalcryptoconference.com. And also check out the amazing event that's being put together by Adam Back and Tone Vase, the Understanding Bitcoin Conference, which is being held on April the 5th to the 7th in Malta. I'm going to be going. The lineup is really, really amazing, with a great group of Bitcoin speakers. Tickets are $500 and they are available at understandingbtc.com. Okay, so on to the interview with Andrew. I have to say, I really love this. This was a really amazing interview. I knew it was going to be out of my depth because, you know, he's a researcher and a mathematician and the stuff he does is highly technical. I watched his presentation at MIT. It did mainly go over my head, but getting the chance to meet him and interview him was something I couldn't turn away. And it was just a really fun interview. It was really interesting to hear the work he does with Bitcoin, hear his thoughts on math, on fungibility. So yeah, I loved this. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. And listen, if you want to support the show, so many people have been in touch supporting me in a number of ways recently. So thank you so much. It's quite overwhelming at times. But if you do want to support the show, there's a section on my website. Just head over to www.whatbitcoindid.com. Click on the support section. There's also a merch section now. You can check that out. All profits are going to go towards buying Lightning nodes for people in the community. So check that out. Okay, hope you enjoy the interview. If you've got any questions, do reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. Hi there, Andrew. How are you?
Hey, Peter. I'm doing very well. How are you?
Very good, thank you. Thank you for coming on my podcast. I'm going to do something slightly different today. I usually do lots and lots of prep, but the things you cover go way over my head. So today, this is the first time I think that I've ever gone without any full prep, apart from like a weird interview I did recently with Pomp. I'm going to just try and let this roll with today. So firstly, I went to your session this morning. I didn't understand any of it. I'm not technical. I'm a Bitcoin fan, and I watched there and I was looking at the screen going, okay, I don't get this. So can you give me the background? Like, you're a mathematician, right?
I am a mathematician.
Right. So give me the background. Tell me about the work you do. And somebody said to me, he's just, Andrew is a big brain of math. So tell me all about this.
All right, so maybe I should start by saying that my talk this morning, I had a bit of an ulterior motive there. I was at MIT, it's full of undergrads. We all know they like to go create startups doing strange, reckless, cryptographic things. And my goal there was to kind of intimidate them out from trying to go build cryptographic protocols that they weren't ready to do the kind of research needed to do this in a high assurance way. So I was trying to be a little bit intimidating when I was doing this. I heard from a few people they didn't understand it. Although, in fairness to me, I wasn't just being mean. I had 20 minutes to cover this topic. I really tried to cut it down. I still ran out of time to say the things that I wanted to say. So the result, and it was at 9:15 in the morning. The tea wasn't working, so I showed up a bit late. I didn't have time to get coffee. Nobody else did. It was not a good time for something so technical. So, right. You know, it wasn't just me being mean there. It was also, you know, that's how these things go sometimes. But to answer your question about what I was talking about, though, or maybe to give a little bit of background on this. So I work at Blockstream. I'm the head of research. And one of our big kind of prongs of Blockstream research is this whole collection of things that I call signature technology, or scriptless scripts, depending on how marketing friendly I feel like being. What these are a whole pile of ways that we have to encode interesting multi-party, I don't want to say like smart contract, well I do, smart contract semantics in signature protocols. So what do I mean by that? I mean that it's possible to create digital signatures or to create what are called multi-signatures. These are digital signatures produced by a set of participants, all working cooperatively in such a way that no subset of them is able to produce a signature. It's like really something that's jointly owned by all of these people at once. And by extending these multi-signature protocols, which are these off-chain protocols where the different parties send various cryptographic objects to each other, by extending these to have other interesting semantics, we can ensure that these parties can ensure that the only way the final signature will be produced, and the only way that a valid transaction, which has to have a signature, will be produced, is if some sort of contract is satisfied. So the simplest example of this that's non-trivial is, say, like an atomic swap, a cross-chain atomic swap, where somebody, say, wants to send some bitcoins to a counterparty, but the only way that they don't want that money to move unless they also receive an equivalent amount in Litecoin on the Litecoin chain, they want to receive that, right? So there's a swap that's happening, a Bitcoin for Litecoin swap. The problem is the Bitcoin blockchain doesn't know about Litecoin, the Litecoin blockchain doesn't know about Bitcoin. Neither one is willing to put like verification code for the other into their consensus layer, of course. So how can you make these two blockchains communicate? There's a standard way to do this, I believe developed by Tyr Nolan in 2013-2012, where basically you encumber coins on both blockchains with what's called a hash pre-image challenge. With basically you say, in order to move these coins, you have to reveal some secret. And the trick is you use the same secret on both blockchains. So initially one party knows the secret, the other does not. And then what happens is the party who knows the secret publishes it to the blockchain to take their coins. Maybe they publish it to the Litecoin chain in order to take their Litecoins. The other party copies the secret off of the Litecoin chain onto the Bitcoin chain and uses that to take their coins. So that way the act of taking the money reveals a secret, which causes the money to be given away. It's possible to extend a multi-signature protocol so that the act of completing a multi-signature reveals a secret. And equivalently, you can extend a multi-signature protocol, or conversely, you can extend a multi-signature protocol such that knowing a secret allows you to complete the multi-signature. And as long as you use the same secret in both sides, the effect is you can have a multi-signature moving coins on Litecoin such that when one party completes a signature to take their coins, they reveal a secret the other party learns by reading the final signature off the blockchain and doing some computations. And then they can use that secret to complete a signature on the Bitcoin side and take their coins. And the cool thing is that what hits the blockchain here are just these two signatures. And what's even cooler is it's not even multiple signatures. It's actually one signature on each chain that the two parties jointly created.
Okay, but are you enabling shitcoining then?
So it's unfortunate that there's nothing that you can, there's nothing on other chains that you can trade with. Let me take that back. Okay. So there are lots of blockchains out there. Not all blockchains have their own asset types. Not all blockchains have shitcoins on them. As one example that's dear to us at Blockstream is we have a sidechain called Liquid. What a sidechain is basically a blockchain that doesn't have its own native asset. It supports what was called a cryptographic peg, or in our case, a federated peg, which is controlled by a consortium of our customers. I think 11 of 15 of them need to, following the rules of the system, they need to sign off that the rules of the system were followed, moving coins off of Liquid into Bitcoin. So Liquid is a separate blockchain that supports Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. It also supports other assets that people can issue, and whatever the semantics of those assets are, that's up to the issuer. That's not so interesting for these purposes. What is interesting is that if you want to move Bitcoins into Liquid, you need to put them up in some output that is controlled by this consortium. That's like an 11 of 15 multi-signature output. And then for it to be recognized and to be moved on the Liquid side of things, we require 100 confirmations, which takes a long time. That takes the better part of a day.
Why 100?
100 is the what's called the maturity limit in Bitcoin. So I'm going to get a little bit technical here. But in Bitcoin, if there's something, if there's a blockchain reorganization, then assuming no foul play, basically all of the same transactions will eventually wind up back on the blockchain. And people who weren't actually trying to exploit the reorg to cause grief will see no effect, basically. Like the transactions just wind up back on the chain, maybe in a different order, maybe in different blocks. That's all fine. So typical users who are not under attack don't really need to worry about reorganizations, except as far as keeping their databases in sync and stuff like this. But there's one big exception to this, which are Coinbase transactions, which are transactions that are created in a new block. So every block, the person who creates the block gets to create this free transaction that gives 12.5 coins to them and has no inputs whatsoever. And if there's a reorg, these transactions are completely destroyed. They can't come, but they can't go back onto the blockchain because the new blocks will have different Coinbase transactions. They'll have different TXIDs.
So if there's a reorg, we reduce the total supply.
No. So the reorg will replace some blocks with other blocks.
Oh, okay.
So the 12.5 coins from the blocks that were destroyed are gone, but there will be a different 12.5 coins.
So the miners who mine those will be slightly upset.
Yes. Yeah. The miners will certainly be upset, but importantly, so will anybody who received coins from these miners. Imagine the miners could create these transactions and then immediately send them off to some other party. The other party would need to look at the blockchain and say, oh, these coins actually came from a Coinbase transaction. So, you know, it's not only if there's foul play, like if there's any reorg at all, and these happen all the time for one or two blocks just because of network propagation effects. If there's any reorg at all, these coins are no good. And so, like, I don't want to accept these coins. They're very risky. So the network, the Bitcoin protocol has a rule, which is you are not allowed to move Coinbase transactions for 100 blocks.
Right.
Right. So, and this is really quite excessive. There has never been a reorg of 100 blocks. There has never been a reorg of more than 20 blocks, 25.
When did that happen? It's quite a long time ago, right?
It was, yeah. And I don't remember the details, so I don't want to anything for sure. But there was, I believe it was related to a database synchronization bug in Bitcoin before it was called Bitcoin Core in 2013 or so.
So Liquid is designed to protect itself against any situation where a reorg might happen.
Essentially, yes. So
okay, interesting.
In Liquid, if there were a reorg so deep that coins moved into Liquid and then later moved out were actually invalidated by a double spend attack or something, then then there's really no recourse to that for users of the system. Basically, the solvency of the system would be in danger. So we needed a limit that was much higher than anything that had been seen before, that was so high that realistically it would cause an ecosystem-wide crisis and stop, and who knows what would happen in the case of such a reorg. And conveniently, Bitcoin Core had such a number that was already being used for such a purpose, which is reorgs of Coinbase transactions, where the idea is that since Coinbase transactions can only be spent after 100 blocks, you as a receiver of coins don't even need to think about whether you don't need to worry like, oh, these coins are less risky than other coins. You can say like after 100 blocks, basically all the coins are as fungible as they're going to get, basically as a rule of thumb. So we just copied that rule of thumb from Bitcoin is essentially what we did. But to bring this back to signature technology, which is much more interesting than
yeah, look how excited you get now.
Yeah, and I'm falling asleep here in front of the mic. To bring this back to signature technology, this means that if you're moving coins into liquid, it's very slow. It's very annoying. It takes a better part of a day. Wouldn't it be nice if you could just swap your Bitcoins on the Bitcoin chain with somebody else's Bitcoin on the liquid chain? And because these are freely exchangeable, other than the time value of the better part of a day, like the price of these should be essentially the same. And so you could use these cross-chain atomic swaps to do this. No shitcoining anywhere in sight.
Yeah, right? Brilliant. So atomic swaps have a purpose now.
Exactly. Atomic swaps have a purpose
Amazing.
Now. Yeah. And so we can do this using digital signatures. It's kind of the cool thing. And maybe the other, well, not the other cool thing, but the reason that I brought up atomic swaps is not because they're inherently a particularly interesting thing, but because it's a simple example of some much more exciting stuff. But before I go into that, let me double back to talked about this morning. So I've been talking about these multi-signature protocols, saying, oh, you can extend a multi-signature protocol to do this, you can extend it to do that, and whatever. Well, the truth is that to do this in a way that's straightforward enough, that there's production-ready code, and that there's reasonably audited and verifiable and constant-time, high-assurance code written out there, you actually can't do this with ECDSA, which is the current signature scheme in Bitcoin. There are a few research projects out there to allow you to do these kind of things using ECDSA. They all involve much more complicated cryptography, significantly more complicated code. The computational requirements for participants are over 1,000 times as much. These take like often multiple seconds on like commodity hardware to do this kind of stuff. The cryptographic assumptions underlying these are much stronger than the elliptic curve discrete logarithm assumption that we're used to using in Bitcoin. ECDSA requires you make all of these trade-offs. You're not making them on the blockchain, but the participants in these protocols will have to make those kind of trade-offs. And that's a hard pill to swallow. And empirically, we've known how to do this in some way or another for several years, I guess 4 or 5 years, and nobody has deployed it in a production-ready setting, even though in principle this is possible on Bitcoin. So ideally, Bitcoin would not be using ECDSA. ECDSA makes this unnecessarily difficult, and it actually does this kind of on purpose. The history of ECDSA is kind of interesting, and is a lesson for anybody who is thinking about patenting cryptography out there. The story there is that in 1989, Klaus P. Schnorr developed a signature scheme called Schnorr signatures. And these are algebraically like a very straightforward type of signature. They're kind of the simplest possible zero knowledge proof of knowledge. They're the simplest possible like kind of example of something called the Fiat-Shamir transform in academic cryptography. It's like kind of a building block for a lot of cryptography that's been built ever since then. But in addition to being a building block of more complicated, more exciting protocols, by itself, these are actually digital signatures, which is cool. That's kind of the simplest thing you can do with cryptography is make a digital signature. Schnorr put a patent on this.
Was it last year, was it?
It was actually a little while ago that it expired. It expired in 2008. So patented this. He attempted to enforce his patent. He demanded royalty payments for anybody who wanted to use it. Nobody used it. Yeah, this has made it just in practice, nobody's willing to use patented cryptography. This was unable to be standardized. Standards bodies didn't want to touch patented cryptography that would involve royalty payments to random private parties. In this case, Dr. Schnorr personally. And so in response, NIST, the National Institute for Science and Technology, developed DSA, I should say. It was actually not elliptic curve based initially, although it was a simple transformation from the original scheme to use elliptic curves. DSA was basically a response to Schnorr, where they took the simple algebraic structure of Schnorr and they made it as complicated as they could without making the signature any larger. I think is a fair way to describe this. It does some very weird things. Like, you take in the elliptic curve variant, you take an elliptic curve point, you compute this, it's like an ephemeral public key that's used as part of the signature, and you interpret one part of this elliptic curve point. You take the x-coordinates, you interpret it as a geometric object, and then you take one of its coordinates, and then you interpret that as a scalar, which is an object like a secret key, and you do some algebra mixing your secret key and your scalars, and you do something called a modular inverse, which is like a division, and none of this stuff is present in Schnorr signature. Schnorr signature, you just multiply and add, which are the simplest things that you can do. And this was developed basically to evade these patents. And Schnorr claimed at various times over the years on I think the CoderPunks mailing list, that ECDSA actually does violate the Schnorr patent despite these changes. But to the best of my knowledge, he never claimed this in court.
Right.
Purely mailing list post. So the result was everybody used ECDSA. It was standardized. That's what people used. And so in 2008, finally, the patent expired. I'm not sure how quickly anybody noticed this. I can tell you that in 2010, Dan Bernstein released the ED25519 signature protocol, which is actually a type of Schnorr signature. It's tweaked in a couple subtle ways to make the signatures faster.
Well, hold on. So the patent ran out the year before Bitcoin.
Yes, exactly.
So it could have been that Satoshi was sitting on it for a while and thought, I'm just going to wait for the...
So it could have been. I don't believe that Satoshi was aware of the patent expiring.
Right,
and okay. The reason I don't believe this is that Bitcoin, in its initial incarnation, used OpenSSL for its signatures. It also used OpenSSL in a lot of other places for its big number library. So Bitcoin script supports, like, initially it supported like addition and multiplication and division of arbitrarily large numbers. And it did this using all these OpenSSL functions. And actually in consensus code, in a few places, there are these kind of obscure data structures and number encodings that come from OpenSSL's BigNum library. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I conclude from this is that Satoshi made a lot of design decisions based on what he could do using commercially available off-the-shelf crypto libraries, which is certainly the right way to design these kind of systems. You really don't want to be rolling your own crypto. But an unfortunate consequence of this is that he wound up using ECDSA because there was OpenSSL code for that. And there wouldn't be OpenSSL Schnorr code. I don't even know if there is any now that I think about that. Until I suspect that OpenSSL supports ED25519 now. I suspect. And then that's Schnorr code. But basically, at the time, there was no library that supported Schnorr signatures. The patent had just expired. Nobody was using them. Nobody was really thinking about them. And also, at this time, even after Bitcoin was launched, it would be quite a while before people started thinking about signatures in the kind of ways that we think about them in the Bitcoin space. Started thinking about these compact multi-signatures and these threshold signatures and these adapter signatures, which is what I call that scheme where you encrypt a secret in as part of the multi-signature protocol. And all these cool things that we talk about related to Schnorr signatures, nobody was thinking about back then. You thought of a signature as, you have some public key, and that's maybe associated to like a key fob that you use to get into a building. The building management has a registry of everybody's public keys and their key fobs. And when you beep into a building, that fob creates a signature on some random nonce that the door chooses. If it's a valid signature, you get in, kind of thing. So the model that everybody was thinking of was one in which you had a fixed set of public keys. You were maybe verifying these signatures with some powerful like door computer, and you were producing them with some tiny, weak piece of hardware or something like that. And that was kind of the application of digital signatures. And then the internet showed up, and digital signatures were used in TLS or SSL to authenticate websites. But the again, the kind of design constraints were essentially the same. You had some overtaxed server producing these signatures. Mm-hmm. It needs to be cheap to produce. Then you had like people's commodity hardware verifying like one for every web page. Who cares about that? You have the certificate authority infrastructure, who like is a canonical list of public keys, and they sign like a new canonical list and so on, and the keys are always fixed, and you're never making multi-signatures, and you're never encoding weird things in the signatures, and they're really just fixed public keys, signing is cheap, verification is you don't care if verification is cheap or not. And so with that context, we can finally double back to what my talk was about this one, which was trying to develop some of these cool applications of Schnorr signatures. So the wider context here is that we hope in the coming weeks to publish a proposal for Bitcoin to extend the protocol to support Schnorr signatures as well as ECDSA and a couple other maybe less exciting things alongside that. And in advance of this kind of proposal, what we want is the ability to do all of these cool things that we're talking about. So we've actually written code to do Schnorr multi-signatures. We've written code to do threshold signatures, which are an extension of that where maybe you've got 10 participants and you want any 7 of them to be able to produce a signature. And there's kind of some cool tricks you can do there.
Schnorr is in Zcash, right?
So Zcash, I believe, uses ECDSA for its unshielded transactions. Right. Because those are essentially just Bitcoin transactions. But for its shielded transactions, it uses some more elaborate cryptographic constructions.
I thought it used Schnorr, but maybe I'm wrong.
I don't know either way.
You probably don't care.
And I don't.
Screw those guys.
Yeah.
All right, but look, this is all just math, right?
This is all just math.
Everything's math, right?
Well, okay. No. I'm going to say no to that. And this is a lot of what my talk was about, which was, if you think of everything as just math, then you necessarily make a lot of simplifying assumptions about how things work in practice. So one example that I talked about in my talk was when you generate a signature, whether this be Schnorr or ECDSA, or most signatures, with a few exceptions, you need to produce some fresh randomness as part of the signature protocol, some fresh secret randomness, and then you basically treat this as an ephemeral secret key, and there's like an ephemeral public key associated to it, which we call a nonce and eventually becomes part of the signature. If this random secret is anything short of uniform, if like you have 256 random bits, but like your 7th bit turns out to be 1 more often than not, then given enough signatures, it's possible for somebody to extract your secret key. And there was actually a paper published about this a few weeks or maybe a month or two ago by Nadia Henninger at UC Davis and a second author, Jacob. I'm forgetting his name now.
I'll look it up.
Yeah. Which did this, actually. It found some biased nonces in the Bitcoin blockchain and was able to extract secrets. Okay. Just using this kind of attack, and they were very slightly biased by only like a bit or two, but nonetheless it was possible to extract the secret. So the way this looks in a mathematical paper is there's a symbol, it's an arrow sign with a dollar above it, and that means like choose randomly, and the dollar is kind of funny. So
yeah, it is, it's ironic really.
It is ironic, and the truth of this has nothing to do with Bitcoin, where these dollars and cent signs come as. The idea is that you're flipping a coin, and a dollar is 100 coins. And so if you need like hundreds of bits, then you take a dollar. You're flipping hundreds of coins is the idea. And there's sort of this visual pun there that that has survived to this day. And now I think modern readers probably think it might have something to do with Bitcoin, but it's not. It's just some ridiculous pun about coin flipping. So you've got this symbol, dollar sign with an arrow below it. And that means uniformly randomness. And you have that for the secret nonce, and you have this for your secret key, and you have this in a few other places. And the reason I say this is not just math is like, if you screw up choosing your private key, so it's not uniformly random, it really doesn't matter. It just has to have sufficient entropy that nobody can guess it. If you screw up choosing your nonce uniformly randomly by even like 1 bit or even less than a bit in principle, then you lose all of your keys and all of your money. And the truth is it's hard to get uniform randomness in practice. You need some sort of source of entropy, some sort of source of unguessable data. You need to somehow whiten that. You need to turn it from whatever distribution you're getting. If you're using like some sort of hardware RNG, it probably changes its distribution based on the heat around it and stuff. You need to somehow what's called whiten that to make it uniform. You need to do this reliably. If you're in like a virtual machine or something, you worry about what happens if the virtual machine is cloned after you choose your randomness, and now you're like actually using the same randomness in two virtual machines. You worry in multi-party protocols what happens if somebody restarts the protocol partway through after someone has chosen their randomness. Will they choose the same randomness? And these problems actually, for the case of single signatures, just ordinary ECDSA or Schnorr signatures, actually solved. What you do is you take your secret key and your message and you just hash that. And it turns out that if you use a hash function like SHA-256, this is so close to randomness that no one has been able to detect a meaningful deviation from uniform. If you put the same input into this twice, you'll get the same thing, of course. But if you're hashing your secret key and your message, the only way to get the same input is if you're signing the same message twice. So you'll just produce the same signature.
Right.
That's no more of a risk than somebody copying and pasting your digital signature. It's not. It doesn't matter. But then as soon as you go into these multi-party protocols, suddenly this matters a lot. Suddenly you need to think, well, actually the random challenge that goes into the signature is something that includes contributions from everybody. So if one party is generating their randomness deterministically this way, such as they'll always generate the same randomness of the same message, and somebody else starts multiple signing sessions of the same message but tweaks their contribution, the result will actually be multiple signatures with the same nonce, and you can steal the private key. And this is scary. And the reason that I answered your question, like, is it just math? No, is that this really isn't just math. The way that this kind of thing happens, which is kind of subtle, and actually often when I talk to people developing multi-signature protocols, they're like shocked and horrified and like hurry to check their code. The way that this happens is that you have these papers that have arrow with a dollar sign, choose uniform randomness. Okay, that's fine. I mean, you assume in for the purpose of papers, you're in this idealized model where you assume sources of randomness. In real life, you think, well, I need some randomness and I don't want to worry about biases from hardware RNGs or lack of entropy or virtual machine splitting or whatever. So instead, I'm going to use some sort of hash function. Okay, and I'm just going to hash all the data that's going into the signature. And this will give me uniformly random data. It's uniform except for the fact that it repeats if you give it the same input. But that's fine. It's fine if it repeats because everything else will repeat and I'm duplicating it. And this is such a kind of obviously safe thing to do that probably nobody even thinks about the assumptions going into that. They think, well, is this hash function really a good hash function? And SHA-2 is perfectly fine. And then that's the end of it. And so you take this kind of unwritten, unspoken assumption that is valid and beneficial and best practice for single signatures, and that appears to not be even really changing the model from your mathematical idealization very much, right? And then you apply it to a new scenario. And suddenly the specific assumptions you made, that repeats can only come by producing the same signature, is wrong. But because you never vocalized that, you don't notice that that was one place where you deviated from the paper, where the actual difference between your ideal paper model and the model in real life is that you now require these repetitions to be either like everything repeats or nothing repeats, right? And the result is that you lose your keys. And this was basically what my talk was about this morning.
Right.
It was just a series of examples of this, of like fairly either simple assumptions that were so subtle that you might not realize you were making them, or assumptions that were so obviously safe that you don't even notice when you carry over to a more general scheme where they actually don't hold, where like suddenly like they were just basically in the background.
I was going to say, you've made my job really easy because I've had one question and we've done half an hour now. So I've only got to do one more question and we're done.
Yeah. Wow.
And I was really scared about this interview. I was like, what do I ask Andrew? He's so clever and I don't know any of this.
So I really appreciate this. So if you watch my talk and actually...
Yeah. I watched the talk.
Yeah.
I took some photos.
I now discourage people from watching my talk if they've heard this podcast, because I was very constrained for time during the talk. I actually went over time and I was still like rushing stuff and skipping things. And the funny thing was that I'd actually intended to skip a lot of stuff in the talk. I'd already removed a whole ton of stuff. So I'm glad to have the opportunity to babble now.
All right. Well, listen, look, let me ask the things that I find interesting.
Okay.
Because
all right.
People are certainly going to listen to that and be fascinated by it. And I am. But at the same time, I'm like, I don't understand a lot of it. But I tell you what I am interested in understanding. So like a couple of things. Firstly, you're a mathematician, right?
Yeah.
What does that mean to you?
Oh, that's a very... personal question.
Let me ask you a funny question. I always start, and I keep talking about it, I start every interview with what is Bitcoin, because every answer is different. And when I did it with, I first heard Adam do it on the Epicenter podcast, it was such a fascinating answer. I've never stopped asking it. What is math? Can you describe math?
So mathematics in general is the art of finding patterns in logical structures and finding connections between seemingly apparently very different logical structures.
That's amazing. That's quotable.
Thank you.
I have a quote for your show. I'm gonna. Yeah. That is all. All right, and just talk me through, like, what was the education progression? You know, when you got interested in math, you've obviously gone through. I'm assuming you've done all the way up to a master's.
Yep.
Yeah. So talk me through that progression and what your thesis was. I probably won't understand it, but I'm fascinated by it anyway.
Certainly. So the progression into cryptography is actually kind of interesting. When I was 12 or 13 years old, I was watching Stephen Colbert, who had his, now he does the Today Show, I guess. But
you probably already had your master's at 13.
Pretty much, yeah. At the time, I had not even started applying to colleges or anything like that, or to university, as we say in Canada.
We say university in England.
Oh, excellent. Yeah. And so I live in Texas now. I'm so used to speaking to Americans that I've adopted their turns of phrase.
Yeah, I do the same.
Yeah. And so I was watching Stephen Colbert, and he was doing this bit on how some cryptographers had decoded some Enigma messages from World War II. And of course, Stephen was laughing, like, you know,
Bletchley don't... Bletchley Park?
Yeah.
That's about 25 minutes from my house.
Wow.
Yeah, I live in Bedford, and Bletchley's just... as a kid, we used to go to the local swimming pool there because it had water slides.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the Enigma machine. Yeah.
That's very cool. Yeah. That's like a mythical place to me. You know,
you've not been?
I've never been, no.
Do you ever come to London?
I have been in London twice for one day because British Airlines stranded me. This happened multiple times.
Right. Next time you're in England, I'm going to get you from the airport and I will take you to Bletchley Park and then you can get your connection, right?
Can you imagine? Oh, so I get those funny stamps in the passport where they say you're only admitted for 24 hours. And I took one of those and then like used it to go to Bletchley Park.
Yeah, Bletchley Park.
That would be a good
get a burger
statement about
see the Enigma machine and then you can get back on.
Yep, absolutely.
So go on.
So of course Stephen was making fun of these guys. Like, you know, don't you know that the war ended 70 years ago? So these messages are not of strategic interest anymore. But what I got from this was like, whoa, that's very interesting that it would be possible to encrypt something so well that like 70 years later. People are still working to decrypt it, especially something like World War II communications, which were extremely high volume. You know, this is not one of those like weird codexes people found in the ground from thousands of years ago where you've got like 20 words to decrypt and it could be anything. So I got very interested in the history of cryptography. I bought this book, The Code Breakers by David Kahn, which is like, it's giant, it's like 4 inches thick. And I read through this and I thought like, wouldn't it be cool to be a cryptographer? But then I got into university and I talked to various people in the mathematics department, and none of them really did cryptography at the university I went to, which was Simon Fraser in Burnaby, British Columbia. And I said, okay, well, you know, we'll see. I mean, I'll start doing a math degree and then I'll just sort of see what I feel like a few years in. And then what happened was, after a couple of years, I went from sort of going through the motions, thinking, well, if I can't do crypto, like I'm just going to just bump through and get a degree and see what kind of happens. I fell in with a group of mathematicians who were like very serious. They were all doing like honors degrees, which seemed like a big deal to me at the time. And they were all studying stuff in their spare time, and they're all reading these papers. Well, actually, I started dating one of them, and then I felt a need to impress her. So,
Did you impress her?
You know, I never did. I did improve my GPA and get into grad school and do a bunch of reading courses and do half of a master's in my undergrad. But it was all like in this kind of this vain attempt.
Where's she now?
She is now in the Bay Area. She's working for Google.
You still friends?
No, I haven't talked to her in a few years, man. I think.
Should show what you're doing now. Yeah. You should say, look, I've fucking leveled up here.
Well, she wasn't impressed back when I was doing it, when I was dating her.
Come on, man. You're like head of research at Blockstream.
That's true. There we go. You should flex.
It out.
Yeah.
So should check it out.
Should also tell her how much I can lift. You know? that'll show her.
Yeah. All right. So, go on. Do you want to know something else funny? Let's see if you can guess it. So, Bletchley Park has come up in one other interview.
Oh.
And it was a very cryptography-based interview. Can you guess who it was with? I'd be amazed if you know. You will know him, but...
All right, I mean, the obvious guess is Adam, but then if you say I'm not going
to
get it...
You need to go older than that.
Oh, Ian Grigg?
Oh, probably older. Like, grandfather of cryptography kind of stuff.
Who have you had? Phil Rogaway? David Chom?
I've met David Chalm, but I don't know Whit Diffie.
Whit Diffie, nice. Yeah. Oh, it's a bit older. Yeah,
he's amazing.
He is really amazing. I see him. I've never spoken to him, but I see he kind of lingers around Stanford. He shows up at conferences. And,
I just sat there for the whole interview, just fascinated by the way he spoke. Next up, I talked to Andrew more about his work at Blockstream and Fungibility, but before that, I got a message from my show sponsors. Okay, so let's talk about my new sponsor, Kraken. Have you checked them out yet? As I mentioned previously, I signed back up with Kraken. I've had my KYC approved. I'm going to be using them for my Bitcoin trades when I balance my accounts at the end of the month. And you know what? On these travels around the world, in each city I've been to, I've had people from Kraken reaching out to me and taking me out and showing me so much hospitality. So massive thanks to those for that. It's also been great meeting people at events and talking to them about the exchanges they're using, hearing about people who are using Kraken or people who've gone back to them. So that's really, really cool. But I've got to share why I love Kraken, why I'm going to be using them. Yes, they are a sponsor. I know that, of course. But for me, there's a number of things that are really important with the exchange I use. I think the most important one is the size of the company. You know, do they have the infrastructure? Do they have the security in place? That's really, really important for me, especially what's happened with other exchanges being hacked. Kraken are a big company. You know, they're $4 billion valuation. They've got their security procedures locked down. I trust them. So that's one of the things. Also, they're doubling down on their investments. I've been talking to them quite a bit about what they're doing and what they're investing in. You know, Jesse's got a huge vision for the business, something I can totally support and get behind. So that's cool. And most importantly, they're just a proper Bitcoin company. You know, Jesse is a proper Bitcoiner. Yes, they allow for the trade of other digital currencies, but Jesse has been somebody that's really supported Bitcoin since he's been involved. He's done a lot of work behind the scenes. So yes, a company I love. Very happy for them to be a sponsor and really looking forward to using them for my Bitcoin trades. So if you want to join me in supporting Kraken, head over to kraken.com, which is KRAKEN.com. Let's also talk about my other primary sponsor, BlockFi, and their new announcement. They announced they are launching crypto interest accounts, which has definitely sparked a whole bunch of conversations. People have reached out to me with questions. I've fed them over to Zach and I'll be feeding the answers back. But if you are interested in these interest accounts, well, here are the things you need to know. They are the only provider offering compound interest on crypto deposits, which is structured similar to high interest savings accounts. They're offering the highest interest rate on BTC and ETH in the market. Interest is earned on the deposit currency. So if you deposit ETH, you'll get ETH. If you deposit Bitcoin, you'll get Bitcoin. And there are no lock-in periods for your deposits. Client assets are custodied by Gemini, who recently announced their digital asset insurance coverage and the completion of its SOC 2 Type 1 security compliance review of its exchange and custodian platform. Very cool. Go and check it out at blockfi.com, which is BLOCKFI.com. God, I keep interrupting you. Come on.
Sorry, no,
so,
all right.
Hey, so with this group of mathematicians.
Right. So anyway, so I started doing real analysis and probability and mathematical physics, actually. Yep. It's really when I started at school, I thought I can't do crypto. Maybe should I do a physics degree? Should I do a computer science degree? And I did math as a hedge. That was my initial thought about a math degree, as a hedge between CS and physics. And so when I started doing math seriously, I started doing real analysis and probability, which are all like very mathematical physics focused forms of mathematics. And I really disliked algebra and number theory. I felt like these fields were this like random hodgepodge of very ad hoc statements that I guess you could prove were true in very ad hoc ways. And it seemed like there was no rhyme or reason or structure to this. And it was just a zoo of stuff that I would have to memorize. And I would never understand how any of it fit together. So I avoided algebra and number theory as much as I possibly could throughout my degree. And I got a degree where I basically did no number theory or real analysis. And from there, I transitioned to the University of Texas at Austin, where I did my master's. And what I was focusing on there initially, what I wrote in all of my application letters, is that I wanted to do mathematical physics. And so I got to Texas. And so a new state and a new country was very far away. It's funny, I grew up right beside the U.S. border, and I thought, oh, America, that's the same as Canada. Like who cares?
You're all the same, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right.
I mean, you guys are a little bit calmer. Yeah.
It was funny. What a shock it was. It turns out Texas is very different from Canada.
Yeah, it's wild. I mean, I've been to Vancouver and I've been to Dallas.
Yeah, there you go.
I mean, they're very different.
Yeah, but the truth, like Vancouver and Bellingham are actually not that different.
Right, okay.
Right. You know, and in terms of the weather, and I mean, there are certainly visible differences, but like it's easy to make that transition.
Yeah.
It was not easy to transition to Austin. So I found myself in Texas. It was very hot. It was very strange. Everybody talked funny. There was like, everything was far away and so big. and it smelled like granite, and you couldn't get herbal tea at McDonald's, and just everything was different. And they
you
wouldn't
can get herbal tea at McDonald's
in Vancouver. You can
really?
Absolutely.
That's so funny. Yeah. And what do you get? Can I have a Big Mac and a herbal tea?
Yeah, you can that's absolutely so do that in Vancouver. Yeah.
You can't get a beer at McDonald's in the UK.
That's true, nor in Canada or really? Most of the US.
You could probably get well, you probably get a gun in McDonald's.
Probably, in yeah, US. In Texas.
In Texas, yeah. Can I have a Big Mac and a Glock 9?
Yeah.
All right.
And so around this time, I started hanging out on IRC, on the Bitcoin Wizards channel, which happened to have just been created, actually, a few months before I showed up in Texas. But I show up, I think, I'm going to do mathematical physics. And then I show up and like everything's weird and I'm like kind of hiding in my apartment for a few months and like hanging out on IRC. And there's all these strange people on this IRC channel, like Greg Maxwell and Peter Woola and Adam Back and Andrew Miller and like all of the people who now we all know and love. But at the time, they were not well known and they were just weird, basically. And now it's like eccentric and endearing, I guess. Yeah. But, you know.
I'm gradually ticking them off as
yeah.
well.
Yeah,
gradually
excellent.
Getting them off.
And these guys were downloading cryptography papers off the internet and just reading them and doing their own research. And I thought, what? That's a thing you can do? I don't need to be part of this. It doesn't matter that there aren't these professors who are doing what I want, because there still weren't, even at UT, anybody doing the kind of cryptography that I had wanted to do as a child. And so they're doing all of this cool stuff. And actually, ironically, they were talking about Schnorr signatures. At this time, they're like, hey, there's this thing that's not ECDSA and it's so much faster and blah, blah, blah. And we hadn't even thought about any of the cool application that I've talked about today. Like at that time, it was purely like, it's algebraically simpler and it's faster. Like, wouldn't it be cool if we had these Schnorr signatures instead of ECDSA? And then for years, it kind of like, because it was basically an optimization, we didn't care too much. But that was my first experience with Schnorr signatures. Was like also proving that there was like no, what we call the malleability, that you couldn't take a Schnorr signature and like somehow change it to be a different signature on the same message, which you can do with ECDSA, and which before SegWit, this would cause all manner of problems, the second layer thing. Okay. You could change TXIDs by changing signatures. With Schnorr signatures, you couldn't do that. That was the kind of thing that we cared about back then. So to be honest, I didn't go to class at all. So in the US...
You dropped out.
I did drop out, but I haven't gotten to that part of the story yet.
Oh, man.
So I started this PhD program. I hadn't done a master's or anything. In the US, in the natural sciences, you just go straight into a PhD, which is a bit silly because the result is the first couple of years are basically coursework, the kind of stuff that you might have done in a master's if you had separate degrees for this. So I never went to class. I just, all these prelim courses. Fortunately, because my undergraduate education had been so blessed, it was a fairly small school, a very small math department, and I had a lot of professors who were willing to personally help me out. There are folks, I mean, you can look these guys up, like Vesel and Nunyuk, or Paul Tupper, or Nilam and Nigam in particular, were basically like personally teaching me mathematics for years at SFU. It was really quite incredible. So as a result of that, I was able to just test out of all of the prelims. So I would show up for class literally at the end of every semester to write the final exams. And otherwise, I didn't go to school. I would just spend all my time doing Bitcoin research.
Right.
And after a few years of this, I sort of like, it became clear that I was not really progressing at all on my PhD in any way. And also became clear that the kind of research that I was doing in the Bitcoin space, while it's very exciting and there's a lot to it, is not PhD level research. It's not deep enough. There's like a lot of cool applications, but ultimately, like, the algebra is small enough to fit on single slides, and it's small enough for me to explain on more like mathematically focused podcasts in the space of 20 minutes. It just wasn't PhD level stuff, but it was the stuff that I loved to do. And it was also very like morally the kind of stuff that I wanted to do. There was kind of a feeling I was getting from the kind of cryptography that people were doing in academia, that it wasn't really focused on real world things. It wasn't really trying to solve problems. It was still very much mired in this idea of having some sort of public key infrastructure, some blessed list of public keys that is set by some authority. And increasingly, the world was seeming to be a place where you don't have these trusted authorities to decide who's allowed to produce signatures and who doesn't. And Bitcoin like really is like the perfect example of that kind of thing. And these Bitcoin people were not only doing the kind of cool cryptography that I found very exciting, but they were doing it very much for humanitarian reasons. They cared about like self-sovereignty. They cared about individual agency and like preventing surveillance and preventing censorship of economic activity. And they were doing this by developing new cryptography. And this just excited me to no end. So after a couple of years of this, I came to love Austin and I wanted to stay there. And a few of my friends from IRC started this company called Blockstream, which I now am, that's now where I am head of research.
Head of research, yeah.
And at the time, it was very much just a collection of IRC people and a few people from the VC world kind of came together and we started this company. And I actually did not join initially. I said, I want to keep doing my PhD because, you know, you need a PhD to be a cryptographer because that's what everyone said. And I mean, I don't want to be rolling my own crypto and so forth. So I did some sort of part-time consulting work for Blockstream for a little while. But after a while of this, it became clear that I was not getting anything out of this PhD. I wasn't going to class. I didn't know half the professors. I actually made a half-hearted attempt to switch from math into computer science. And like, it's not like when you're doing a bachelor's degree, you can't just switch. I actually applied to a separate PhD program and got in, and then I dropped out of that. And then I dropped out of the first one. So I dropped out of two PhD programs when it became clear that Blockstream would sponsor my visa to stay in Austin.
That's a fair thing to swap. All right.
So. And just walked away from academia completely.
Wow.
And the funny thing here is going way back, all the mathematical physics, all the real analysis that I do now has nothing to do with what I do. Now I need to know algebra and number theory, the things that I tried so hard to avoid.
Is that because you just didn't like them? So, for example, when I did math, right, I did it to I stopped at GCSE level in the UK, 16, right? And there were things I just didn't understand. Did you not understand it or just not enjoy it?
I did not enjoy it. So some parts of it I did not understand. So especially in higher algebra, there are these things, there's like schemes and sheaves and categories and like real mathematicians listening to this podcast are laughing at me because I'm like forgetting
what these words. Come on, man.
I do. I have business cards that say mathematician.
Yeah, I've seen it. You're a mathematician.
Yeah. But people doing like really intense, like PhD level algebra, like really the kind of stuff where you can focus on one problem extremely deeply for years on end, which is, it's a beautiful thing. I sometimes miss the opportunity to do that. That's like, I mean, the one thing that I gave up walking away from academia.
Let me ask you something. I saw a film recently and I can't remember the name, but it's about this guy who's raising his sister's daughter because the sister killed herself and this kid's a genius. And it talked about her sister had been working on one of these seven unsolved problems. Is that a real thing? Like, there are these big unsolved math problems out there.
Oh, yes.
So that was a real thing?
That is, yeah, absolutely.
Wow. So how many are left?
So I believe there were 10 and there are seven. You can look this up. These are called the Hilbert problems, the Millennium Problem.
That was in this film. Mm-hmm. They're unsolved.
Yes, that's correct.
Have you looked at any and thought, I'm going to do that?
Yeah.
You have? Which one did you look at? Because you go down, you get legendary status if you solve one, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So which ones have I looked at? The one that's maybe most familiar to me now is actually P versus NP, or the set of programs that you can efficiently compute the same as the set of programs whose computation you can efficiently verify.
Yeah, I mean, I've got no idea what you're saying, but tell me anyway.
Well, the answer is obviously no, but nobody knows how to prove this. And actually, if the answer were not no, then probably cryptography would not be a thing anymore. Like, that would be it. Like, that would be, like, really the ultimate destruction of everything that I've done, and everyone who you've talked to who's a cryptographer, it would just like completely be obviated. It would be meaningless.
You'd be screwed, man. What would you do? Like, you have to do something new.
Yeah.
You have to go back to your PhD.
I might do that.
But your Bitcoin would be worthless, so you'd need to get a job.
Right, yeah.
You'd be so fucked. Could there be new problems? Like, there was these 10.
Yeah.
Someone go, oh, look, I found a new problem. It's so fascinating. It's so out of my depth.
It's unfortunate. Like, we could look them up if you want, but actually most of them, even if you read them, like, it's hard to understand what they mean, and it's hard to...
They're all on a wall somewhere, right? At one university, is that right? It's in this film. I'll send you the link to the film, because the film's fascinating. This little kid, she's so smart, but it's a real story about this.
It'll probably be at Cambridge, because I believe that's where David Hilbert worked in the late 1800s, early 1900s.
No, it's in the US. I thought, or maybe it's just the film. Maybe it's been Hollywoodized.
It might have been Hollywoodized. Right. I'm sure that Hilbert was a Brit. Maybe I'm wrong about that.
Well, listen, I'm conscious of time, and this okay. is God. This I could literally talk to you for hours. I was scared of this interview, thinking, "What am I going to talk to him about?" This is so fascinating. Okay, so you're head of research.
Yep.
Have you always been head of research since you?
No. No. So when I started at Blockstream, Gregory Maxwell was there.
He
was
of course.
Yep. He was the CTO, and at the time we were a smaller company than we are now. And all of our, basically everybody doing any sort of engineering was more or less a researcher. Like we were combining our sidechains research and our crypto research and like our actual like development of Liquid and its open source counterpart called Elements. And Greg would more or less oversee all of this kind of stuff. And we grew in this, Greg's position as CTO became increasingly like a management position and increasingly being like a bridge between engineering and product and like a lot of stuff that I don't think Greg enjoyed doing every day. And I think he found that he was being pulled away from the kind of cool problem solving that he always loved doing. And so last year, I guess at the beginning of 2017, he left. He gave us like 6 months notice or something. He gave us quite a bit of notice, fortunately. And so when he left as CTO, this left kind of a gap as far as research management. At that time, we kind of restructured a bit, so the day-to-day engineering was not so much in Greg's hands. But there were still a few gaps, in particular around our kind of long-term pie in the sky, or even just like, not even pie in the sky, but things with a long time horizon, that kind of research. A lot of it was fairly deep and cryptographic, and at this point, we'd moved past the like, oh, look at these Schnorr signatures, they're not malleable kind of phase, and we were doing quite involved research. So in lieu of Greg, we created a new position, the director of research, which Greg asked me to take, where basically initially the way this was pitched to me was that I would more or less kind of make sure that the three or four people we had doing just their own research project, just sort of make sure that, you know, they were still alive and like that they were happy and, you know, they would keep doing what they were doing. And maybe I'd have to show up at some meetings every week or something like that. But really I could keep on doing like my own research projects and it wouldn't be a thing. And but we needed somebody who was in charge of research who could talk to the media and stuff like this. And of course that's not how things went. I mean, I got into this and then like 5 minutes later I was in charge of patent strategy and then I was showing up at like management meetings all the time. And then I was having to set like the direction of our various research initiatives and having an idea of like how this would turn into productization and all of this stuff. And I was talking to the press quite a bit more than I'd expected. And I found myself having kind of less time to be doing this research. Like, and it's a lot of fun that I get to go talk about this stuff. But the truth is all the real heavy lifting is being done now by Peter Woola and Jonas Nick and Tim Ruffing. And I actually, it's a lot of fun. It's kind of surprising. If you'd asked me a few years ago about that, I would have been horrified by the idea. I would have said, oh no, I want to keep like writing. I want to keep, you know, doing mathematics all day and doing crypto research.
But it's kind of interesting, right? Because it's not that you're just, I guess for your role as head of research for Blockstream, you're really a researcher for Bitcoin.
Right. Yeah. And then personally, like my motivations and everything that I do and even everything that Blockstream Research is doing ultimately comes down to like what would be good for the Bitcoin ecosystem and what will move the Bitcoin ecosystem towards the kind of world that I want to see where all coins are like fungible, where all outputs look the same, where things are efficient enough that that people can actually use the system, where it's private enough that people don't have to worry about like their landlord knowing when they get a raise, or like businesses don't have to worry about exposing their financial stuff to other people.
Is that a lot of your work at the moment on fungibility then?
Yes, indirectly. So a lot of my work, most of the work that I focus on the research side is this scriptless script signature tech stuff that I've been talking about. And these kind of join the two things that I care about, which are privacy and scalability, in the sense that all of the result of all of this cool tech is that you can do these very intricate, interesting smart contracty kind of things, and the result, what hits the blockchain, is just a signature. And it's not even like a marked signature in any way. It's just like an ordinary signature that secretly was generated in a way that involves some sort of cool multi-party conversation there. But in the end, you see one public key and you see one signature, whether or not you have coins owned by one person or owned by multiple people or owned like split custody with some other thing with like a time lock backout kind of thing or like a lightning channel or whatever, these all just look the same.
Right. Does that mean you're basically going to be screwing with chain analysis?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Because let's be honest, they're evil, right?
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting, like...
So how far away are we from seeing this?
So I hope that in the next couple of weeks, we should finally write down our proposal and submit that to the Bitcoin mailing list. We've been going back and forth a whole lot on this thing called Sigcash No Input, which unfortunately is like kind of tangential to everything else. But if you're going to have a new signature, you might as well have new rules for what exactly it signs. So this thing called Sigcash Mode, which Lightning folks and a few other folks want a extension to this called Sigcash No Input, where basically you don't sign any details of the coin that you're spending. And this lets you like rebind transactions to different transactions. This lets you do some layer two stuff more efficiently. And doing that safely and doing that in a way that won't encourage reckless behavior or loss of the privacy and fungibility has been actually harder than every other part of the Schnorr signature stuff combined. And unfortunately, this is the kind of stuff that we have to nail down before we can do a proposal because this is consensus rules.
Right, okay. So, but what's the process? So you get your paper, you send it out to the Bitcoin mailing list.
Yep.
Is that like a peer review process?
Yeah, yeah. So we publish something to the Bitcoin mailing list. We finish. We basically write a draft of what will become a BIP. And so we have to write code alongside this. But actually, we've written almost all of the code for this. We actually have working code for all of these things. We just need to nail down a bunch of like parameters that we need to nail down. We publish this to the mailing list.
Yep.
People will reply in various ways, saying like, "Hey, you know, I want to use this in this way. Like, you need to support this. This breaks such and such a use case. I worry that people are going to use this in the wrong way and could possibly lose funds. I worry that this is unsafe. I worry this is too complicated. I worry it's not complicated enough," and so on.
That's quite interesting. Yeah. So I've talked about I talked about it with Brian Bishop. He talked to me about BIPs and how they work, and it's very interesting because I assume they're just checking to make sure, you know, you've not screwed anything up. You've thought about everything. But actually, people can widen the scope by saying, okay, this is cool. That's really interesting. I didn't know
that. Yeah, absolutely. And they'll also say, you know, this is a new version. So one thing that SegWit introduced is this notion of script versioning, the way to version Bitcoin outputs. And this proposal will take a new version number. It will be the first use of the SegWit versioning scheme. And people will say, like, is this everything that we want in this version one, the first one of the version zero output? Is this everything that we want in version one outputs? And there are a whole bunch of stuff that we wanted to do that we actually had to remove from scope. Because the design complexity was too high and we just weren't getting toward the proposal. And I'm sure people will talk about some stuff like that. And so my guess is that this period of discussion will actually not last too long. I think we'll have like maybe a month of back and forth on these kind of design things. And then we go into and hopefully design will quiet down and we'll be in a position where we have like a BIP and we'll get a BIP number and then now we have a proposal. Well, a proposal is just a proposal. Next, we need to think about, if we want to deploy this, how are we going to deploy this? How are we going to get consensus? And there's a whole discussion around that, and there's a whole discussion around the scheduling of that. And I'm separate enough from Bitcoin protocol development that I can't really say what that's going to look like. And actually, I think nobody's really quite sure that the last major change, of course, was SegWit, and there was a lot of crazy politicking that most of us did not expect going into it, and a lot of things that were just really very much against the Bitcoin ethos.
Okay. Yeah, but that's slightly different. So, okay, say it gets through the peer review process, everyone's happy. How long does it take for like the code to become deployed? And is this to be deployed on core?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So what it will look like is suppose everybody agrees this is what we want, this is how we want to deploy it. We have code already that you can merge into core. I guess there are a few like parameters we've got to nail down. So we pretty much have code already in core. That would go into the next Bitcoin core release, the code for the deployment, although it might not yet have the parameters for activation yet set at that point.
Okay.
But it would be in Bitcoin core. It would be something you could review. It would probably be something that you could test on reg test or something like this. And then there will be a discussion about what the actual activation parameters are. And then some date far in the future, and I don't want to make any guesses as to what this would look like. 6 to 12 months.
Oh, wow.
Like after we've decided this is what we want to do, and we have code, and it's gone through the code review process. So in addition to the protocol peer review, it has to go through code review.
So this could be 2020.
I think so, yeah.
And so if this comes in, are we going to have full fungibility at that point?
This has been such an optimistic interview up to this point.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's exciting.
So there are a couple trade-offs that you have to make when you're using this kind of stuff versus using a more typical, like, Bitcoin check multi-sig, like everybody publishes individual signatures and everyone sees a policy kind of thing. One big one is that everybody who's participating in the schemes needs to interact to do so. So there's an additional protocol complexity to doing this. And so on the wallet side, it will actually be quite a while before wallets will upgrade, for multi-signature wallets to upgrade to use this kind of stuff. Although they are certainly incentivized to, because the resulting signatures will be much smaller. Mm-hmm. But it is like an interactive protocol. It's quite a bit of complexity and R&D that needs to be done to actually deploy this. But there are a few people who have significant incentive to deploy this quickly.
Say I have a wallet that has activated and you haven't. What does that mean? If I send something to you, am I anonymous but you aren't?
So what it will look like is when the coins are sitting in your pocket, they will look indistinguishable from anyone else using this version. Even if you have some weird multi-sig policy going on, even if you're like actually some split custody with some company like BitGo or like Blockstream's green address or some other company doing that, no one will be able to tell what exactly you're doing. And even after you spend the coins, no one will be able to tell what your policy was when you spent them. But then they'll show up in my pocket. And actually, if I give you a fresh address, even if it's an old address, it's still nobody's going to be able to tell anything. But when I spend those, if I've got some sort of multi-sig policy, people will say, ah, that looks like some sort of multi-sig. Ah, that looks like a BitGo transaction. That looks like a Liquid transaction, whatever. So it's only upon spending that these fungibility improvements start to become apparent. And the reason for that is that already in the version 0 outputs, if you're doing complicated scripts, the output is just a hash of the script, and you don't reveal the script until spending time. So the real benefits come with like coins that are moving a lot. And so if you have, so then let me say the other trade-off. So the first one is interactivity. The other one is that you need your keys online, and that sort of comes with interactivity. You can't have some keys in a vault where you take them out and then you like create a signature and you like carry the signature out of your vault and then like put it into a computer. I mean, you can, but because of an interactive protocol, you're going to have to turn right back around and go into the vault for the second phase of the protocol. And it's very annoying. It's probably not practical in real life. So this would be the kind of thing that you want for coins that are moving a lot, definitely, because you get the improved privacy and fungibility. And that's where the big fungibility gains are to be made. But if you've got coins that you consider to be like in long-term storage, you probably should just leave them on the old school outputs, I think.
Right, okay.
Yeah, and we'll continue to have for quite a long time, we'll have coins in these old school outputs, which is unfortunate because they won't get to share the private. They'll clearly be old school outputs.
But at some point, I guess you can bounce them around between wallets and then...
Yep. Yeah, I mean, eventually, if you want to bring those coins back into the economy, like, you can do so, and then at that point, you should move to the new output type, and then you can
get
all the
benefits.
This is
going to be a real problem for regulators, right?
It's really not. So historically, regulators have gotten information on people's financial activity by talking to financial institutions, and they have various reporting requirements. And in order to be various types of financial institution in anywhere in the United States or Europe or Canada or the UK, you have to comply with these regulatory requirements that include a lot of reporting requirements and know your customer requirements and so forth. And traditionally, that's been done by voluntary reporting. And when this Bitcoin stuff came out, a lot of these regulators got this kind of gleam in their eye. And they're like, wait a minute, what if we don't have to talk to anybody? And what if we don't have to make it visible what we're doing to track all of this information? Why can't we just copy it out of the blockchain? And they hire people like Chainalysis and so forth to extract this information directly from the blockchain. But that was never something they could do before Bitcoin. And in fact, I think a lot of people are not using Bitcoin because this is possible. And so we're really just like, it's not even like going back to the status quo of cash. What it's going to look like, well, it kind of is in a couple of ways. But for ordinary users who are storing their coins in banks or in exchanges or some custodian who is subject to regulatory requirement, they will still have to be in compliant with the same sort of regulatory requirements that they would have had before to be interacting with the economy. And it's a concern that regulators have, is this allows people to be their own bank and to store their own money and to transact like that. This is already a problem that regulators have with cash. And this is maybe not something that that you notice living in the UK or even in Canada where I came from, but in the southern United States, almost all of the economy is actually cash-based. And people still, they do the reporting, they do audits, they pay their taxes and stuff. More or less because that's what they need to do to be in a functioning society. And the regulators don't depend on this kind of draconian abilities that they've acquired over the years. And I'm sure they'll be sad to see these go, but I don't think it's a problem for them.
I think they could be alarmed through myths.
Hmm. They certainly could be alarmed through myths. So the worry that I hear from some people is that I am making the world go completely dark and like anything can happen and nobody can tell what's happening, basically.
You're the dark overlord then.
Yeah.
Are you enabling terrorists and criminals?
I've heard this from people. But
does that play on your mind at all?
No. So
okay.
There are two answers that I have, depending on who I'm talking to. And I guess I don't really know who your audience is, but that's fine. So to regulators, I point out that all of this privacy technology still admits the ability to create audit trails and to know who your customer is and the ability to follow the law. And in fact, in a lot of ways, this makes these reporting requirements easier to comply with and more secure to comply with, because you can do things like attaching committing audit logs to a Bitcoin signature using the signed contract construction. So nothing hits the blockchain, nothing's visible on the chain. But now you've got a cryptographic commitment to whatever auditing requirements are required associated to that transaction that is anchored to that transaction in the blockchain. And actually secretly, your Bitcoin signature is also signing this data. So that's the kind of stuff they should be happy about, that kind of thing is possible. That's cool. When I talk to like actual financial regulators, people creating the rules, like they're actually kind of excited about it. They think that's cool.
Okay.
But the other thing that people mean when they say regulators are like Congress people, right? People who aren't like, I mean, I guess they make laws, but they don't know what they're doing. And they don't, there's kind of a hysteria that they're worried about, that this is somehow enabling cyber criminals or money launderers or terrorists or whatever. And the truth is that money laundering is a very large industry in this world. It's a very high margin industry. And by making privacy technology cheaper, we're doing two things. One is we're taking the margins from those people who are bad people, but we aren't making this kind of criminal behavior, like the actual drug trafficking or whatever's happening behind the scenes, we're not making that any easier. Because those industries already, by virtue of being black market industries, are operating outside of the law, and they have these incredible margins, first of all, and they're spending an incredible amount on being criminals, like evading people chasing after them and stuff like this. And so their financial shenanigans are just like one part of that wider cost. And maybe we make that one part a little bit cheaper, but oh well, they're still in a very high margin business, I guess. Like, that's not going to enable anything that wasn't enabled before. But the people who benefit from cheap privacy, who can't participate in the economy in a private way because it's too expensive, are ordinary people who are trying to live their lives, trying to pay their rent and trying to buy their groceries without these credit card companies and their advertisers and the credit agencies and their landlords and their governments watching their every move and using this information to develop profiles on them, which is then used for all sorts of nefarious purposes, like a lot of the psychological warfare that advertising companies like to engage in. That's the kind of thing that you can't avoid as an ordinary person without spending a lot of time and effort paying ATM fees all the time and like carrying giant wads of bills around and worrying that somebody's going to mug you and being unable to spend money online and just all of these crazy inconveniences. And you can't pay your rent in cash in most of the United States anymore because of this kind of thing. Those are the people who suddenly will be able to transact free of surveillance and free of censorship because of this. And those aren't bad people. Those aren't people who shouldn't be able to do this.
No, that makes total sense.
Right. The people who shouldn't be able to do this are already doing it, and they can afford to do it no matter how expensive we try to make it.
All right, man. I'm sold. Bring fungibility on. We have crushed an hour and 7 minutes without even thinking. That was so easy. I'm just conscious of time. It's late. You're tired.
Yeah, I am. I'm tired. My mouth is dry. I need to sleep.
So one final question, and you can keep it as short as you want. The first thing I saw of yours was your presentation about Mimblewimble. That was very interesting. And now we've seen it appear on Grin and Beam. How do you feel about that?
It's very interesting. So Mimblewimble appeared completely anonymously, like Bitcoin style. Somebody dead dropped this text document on Bitcoin Wizards. I became involved in the project fairly early on. The way it worked was a bunch of extensions of this confidential asset stuff that I mentioned very early on. So I had been thinking about this kind of crypto already. And so when I saw like there were a couple like really cool innovations that this Voldemort guy had come up with as part of Mimblewimble, and I was able to pick those up pretty quickly, and I did a few talks about it. I did a talk at Scaling Bitcoin in Milan explaining what this protocol was. And shortly after that, the Grin project started, also operated by a whole bunch of anonymous people using Harry Potter names. And I find this kind of culture of anonymous cryptography fascinating and endearing in a way. It's very strange that there's kind of this novel research and development that's happening by people who are not trying to gain credit or credentials or even like having a reputation to back the research with, just like kind of throwing it out there and like hoping that it sticks or hoping that it gets enough traction without anybody clearly backing it. And I feel like this is a kind of like thing that you might expect reading old science fiction novels to see that kind of society develop, where like people are anonymously pushing forward the frontiers of science, and like somehow information can live on its own and live and die by its own merits. And this is a very like idealistic kind of utopian vision. And I really enjoy seeing that kind of thing play out in real life. And of course, the real world is not so simple and clean as this, but it kind of, in this one respect, it kind of is. Right, the fact that you can have these anonymous papers, and actually Voldemort cited a whole bunch of these other ones in the Mimblewimble paper, and you can go look these up. And so there's actually a long history in the Bitcoin ecosystem and in the cryptocurrency space, this kind of anonymous stuff. And I think it's delightful is my answer to that.
Is it coming to Bitcoin?
Mimblewimble?
Mm-hmm.
Not anytime soon.
Okay.
So that's a much longer answer, but in short,
we'll do that another day.
Yeah, we'll do that another day, but I can give you a soundbite for it, which is basically right now, Bitcoin's soundness is unassailable. You can verify the soundness of the system by downloading the transactions, by checking that the amounts of every transaction are equal on the input and output, I guess less the transaction fee. There's been no inflation at any point in Bitcoin's history.
Amazing.
If we replace that unassailability, you look and add up the numbers with a cryptographic assumption, no matter how strong it is, that would be a change in Bitcoin security model that I think would be a tough pill for a lot of people to swallow.
Right.
So that's the biggest. So there are lots of more detailed reasons that Mimblewimble needs a lot more development and improvement before it could be something we consider for Bitcoin. But I feel like that's the big moral hump that we'd have to get over to move in that direction.
All right. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this. Okay, just to close out, how do people follow you? How do they follow your work?
All right. So I am on IRC as Andy Toshi.
Wow. So everybody says Twitter first. You've gone IRC.
I do not have a Twitter account.
I know.
I do not.
You're missing so much fun.
I know.
We have so much fun.
So people text me Twitter links, and that's how I read Twitter, is by getting links by text.
You're missing all the trolling, all the fun.
Yeah. You can follow what I'm working on GitHub, github.com/apolstra. And you can find, I think my email address is on GitHub. If you don't, it's apolstra@wpsoftware.net. You can shoot me an email and chat with me about what I'm doing. If you're in the Austin, Texas area and you want to buy me some coffee or a beer, I will show up at least once to talk to you.
Well, I'm going to be there. What is it? I think it's the 20th.
Yeah.
And I was going to meet up with Justin.
Yep.
Maybe we can go. I owe you a beer after that.
All right.
I'm going to take you for a beer when we hit Austin. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, definitely shoot me a message in some way. And,
all right.
I will probably be in Austin on the 20th.
Amazing.
So there we go. That is how to follow me. You travel to Austin, Texas, and
buy me a beer.
That's right. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Cool. Thank you. This is a lot of fun.
Okay, so what did you make of that? Did you enjoy that as much as I did? Could you tell how much we were enjoying that? It was a really just fun interview. I really enjoyed that. I don't know why we kind of bounced off each other so well, but, you know, spent a lot of time in the interview laughing. But at the same time, it was fascinating to hear about scriptless scripts and Andrew's work on Bitcoin with fungibility and his work doing research. I really, really enjoyed this. And I do feel like over time, my technical knowledge is improving. Yeah, it might be slower than other people, but I think I'm getting there. And I know I'm not the only one who finds the tech stuff difficult. And I've had a lot of people write to me and say they enjoy the shows because it provides some kind of bridge between the very techie and the not so techie. So yeah, I hope you enjoyed it. If you've got any questions about the show, do reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. And a massive thank you to everyone who supports the show, from those who leave me a review on iTunes to those who sponsor the podcast. Actually, everybody who's come up to me at these conferences I've been at and just telling me how much they enjoy the show, it means a lot. So thank you so much. But if you do want to support the show, there's a whole bunch of things you can do. Firstly, just check out the ads. It's the sponsors like BlockFi and Kraken and Cash App that enable me to do this, enable me to travel around the world and meet these great people and do these interviews. So thank you so much to those, but please do check them out. You can become a patron. If you don't want to hear the ads, you can head over to patreon.com/whatbitcoindid. Now up to 88, which is cool. For $5 a month, you can get the show early and without ads. If you don't want to use Patreon and you want to subscribe, you can use crypto. If you drop me an email, I'll send you an address and add you to the distribution list. I'm also accepting Lightning payments via tipping.me. So drop me an email. We can figure that out if you want to do that. I've also got merchandise available on the website now, which is really cool. I'm doing this in partnership with layer1btc.com. So thank you to them for that. All profits from this from my side will go towards buying Lightning nodes for the community. So I'm not going to take any money from this. I will use that for buying Lightning nodes for people. So yes, if you head over to my website or layer1btc, you can see the merchandise and yeah, maybe you'll want to buy something from it. You can also become a show sponsor. If you're interested in doing that, please email me on hello@whatbitcoindid.com. Last month was over 150,000 downloads. This month looks like I might exceed that. I don't know. We'll see. It's always very exciting to see what happens there. You can leave me a review on iTunes or you can click on the subscribe button. You can follow me on social media. I'm @whatbitcoindid on everything. My personal Twitter is @PeterMcCormack. You can check out my website, which is www.whatbitcoindid.com, and you can subscribe to the newsletter and you can also share the show out with your friends and family. Whew. All right. I'm through that. Okay, I'm about to catch my flight to LA. I've got some great interviews lined up over the next couple of weeks. I've got Mark Weinstein, one of the co-founders of the Fyre Festival. I've got Eric Voorhees, I've got Angela Walsh, and I've got Chris Paniski. So yeah, some very cool interviews coming up. Okay, I hope you have a great weekend. And remember, if you want to reach out to me, my email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com.